Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the foundational beliefs about our country is that we are a nation of doers and makers. But sometime in the last generation, we began to think of ourselves instead as a nation of consumers. Now, we are most certainly both. Interestingly, there's been pushback on that latter idea in recent years, and technology has added a helping hand. Today, whether you're making computer software, a digital film, a music project, or a new industrial product, technology is allowing individuals, once again, to create these products rather than corporations or capital-heavy mass production. And one example of that is the Fab Labs, community spaces where a diverse collection of personal digital fabrication tools in a workplace is ending up as a community center for innovation, education, and entrepreneurship. More than 100 representatives from Fab Labs, Hackerspaces, and the Make Movement will be visiting Tulsa this week as a part of the 2012 Symposium for the United States Fab Lab Network. Tulsa recently opened a Fab Lab, the Hardesty Center for Fab Lab Tulsa at 710 South Lewis, and they'll be hosting this symposium. The keynote speaker will be Dale Doherty, the founding editor and publisher of Make Magazine and the co-creator of Maker Faire, which takes place at various places around the country where inventors, tinkerers get together and show off products, some just for fun, some as perhaps future inventions and with commercial applications. Doherty started Make Magazine in 2005. He's also been a lecturer at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. He was honored by the White House as a champion of change, and he's one of the leaders in the Make movement. He'll be talking about that as the keynote speaker for the symposium this week at the Fab Lab here in Tulsa. Dale Doherty, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
For some time, we've been hearing a lot of rhetoric about how, quote, Americans don't make anything anymore, unquote. And at some time, we went from this belief that Americans were a nation of makers to a nation of consumers. What has led to that change, and do you think there's any truth to it?
Well, I think there is truth to it. But at the same time, what I've come to realize is that we are a nation of makers. It's just not as visible to us sometimes. It's not what we see first. We have become used to saying, can I buy something, rather than can I make it? And when we can't find it in a store, we just don't think it can exist. But I think what we're looking at is, you know, something that I thought in ways Martha Stewart understood when she was doing things is, you know, when we have people over, we tend to make dinner for them. You know, we tend to make a blackberry pie because, you know, they ask questions about, hey, did you make that? And they feel it's better, and they enjoy it more, and it leads to better conversation. They say, no, I got it at the grocery store. It was on sale for $2.99. You know, it's frames who we are differently.
And that goes from making dinner to making small tools, tinkering, inventing. Right. And one of the things your magazine does is it documents all this from just the guy who says, you know, I wonder if I can make this, to the person who's out there with the next great idea.
Yes. I created Make Magazine because I thought I had sort of a couple ideas, but one of them was that, you know, technology really did not have a lot of, it didn't have a magazine that told you how to do projects. And they had magazines and other websites tell you what to buy and what the latest gear is. But we'd kind of lost this sort of hobbyist or enthusiast sense of what playing with technology is like. And you know, again, use cooking or gardening or woodworking. There are magazines out there, and you don't buy those magazines unless you do things. You know, you do projects on the weekend. And I thought, well, you know, if you really love technology like many of us do, you're probably doing some cool things with it, not just, you know, again, not just buying consumer products, but actually hacking them and doing fun things with them. As I began to develop the idea for the magazine, I went back and looked at, oh, Popular Mechanics from the 1950s, 1920s, and Popular Science. And I really saw this was something that is part of, you know, certainly American tradition of tinkering, that we like to do things. We like to make things. And I felt, again, that had sort of receded, and it wasn't being talked about a lot. And I wanted to bring that back and celebrate it and not just talk about it, but really show people how to do things that they would find satisfying to do.
It's really interesting you mentioned those magazines, because now when you see those magazines, it's about multi-million, billion-dollar projects that's on a huge industrial scale. And yet, we're technologically on the cusp where do-it-yourselfers are entering, I would call it a new era of artisan engineering, if you will, where you're able to make things that you can either sell or at least operate in your house or in your backyard from, you know, doing it yourself, not having to have an industrial processed sort of invention.
And I think one of the things we've, you know, I think we've shifted it from just being sort of practical, oh my God, I got to spend Saturday fixing the toilet, to, hey, I'm looking forward to Saturday. This is going to be fun. This is what I really love to do. And, you know, it taps into abilities that I have and want to develop. So I think this is not important for adults, obviously. It's important for kids. And I think many of us, when we look at our school systems, feel that we've reduced learning to something that involves a lot of rote memorization and testing. And it's kind of lost the love of learning, like exploration. And many of the engineers and scientists that I talk to grew up tinkerers. You know, they grew up exploring the world around them, figuring it out, taking things apart, putting them back together, you know, making things on their own, and asking those kind of questions. What happens if I put this connected to that?
Well, that's the whole thing is, you know, the tech classes that used to be mechanical in nature, about taking things apart, putting them back together, have now all become computers, which there's a certain group that gravitate towards that. But for the rest of us, it's a box of mystery.
how it
works
again, and I think the computer is still one of, you know, it is almost the key or central tool in our tool chest, but there are these other tools as well. And what we're really kind of talking about in making is the connection between the physical or analog and the digital or computer oriented activities. You know, to be able to design that new object, now we can actually use something like a 3D printer and create one of them, and that's a new capability that I think we didn't have 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Oh. Well, you mentioned earlier the idea of tinkering and hobbyist. I mean, you talk about kids. You know, I think in this day and age, for the most part, you hear tinkering, hobbyist, that screams nerd.
Yeah.
Do we have to change that viewpoint, that perception?
Yes and no. I mean, I think we actually have a culture now that increasingly celebrates nerddom, if you will.
That's true. Yes, it is.
And, you know, and for me, often it is, you know, we shouldn't be ashamed of that. You know, these are often, you know, you meet a hobbyist or someone who likes steam engines, for instance, and boy, if you get them going, they'll talk all day long, and you could learn a world of things and experience things that you would never have the opportunity online or, you know, through a book. So they're often a great resource in our communities that doesn't go recognized. But I don't think that's why I use the cooking analogies. You know, not everybody who cooks is a gourmet chef, but you can still get a lot of satisfaction out of that. And, you know, programming a computer doesn't make you a geek. It's something that you do. It's a tool you're using. You can be whoever you want. I that's what I want to encourage people to be, that we don't want to sort of get locked into cultural stereotypes of who people are because of certain interests they have.
Well, you know, one of the things when we think about inventors, we think of a commercial application. One of the things I think you celebrate is tinkering for its own merits. And your magazine shows us people with the next great idea, but they also show people who are inventing Rube Goldberg devices, or not necessarily the better mousetrap version, but, you know, crazy inventions just for the sheer sake of, can I make it, can I do this?
Well, exactly. And what's important to me is also that this is the true source of innovation, of invention. It's that, you know, inventors are lucky if they're able to commercialize their invention, but they didn't often start out with just that commercial idea. They've been playing, they've been immersed in an area, they've been fooling things. You know, we forget, you know, that Alexander Graham Bell wasn't an engineer, you know. He worked, you know, in a school for the deaf. And you know, a lot of the inventions that we look around in our world were created by people that probably, if you'd ask them or someone, you know, that was a friend, they would not have expected that person to be that inventor. And I think I'm trying to get across that we all do this, that we're all makers. We all have this capacity to create and make things. And none of us fully understand where that leads us. We dive in and we start doing it, and someone realizes by doing it that there's a need for something, and that it seems very logical at that point. They don't sit on the sidelines and start dreaming of what to do. They actually do it, and then good ideas come to them.
Well, it's interesting as we talk, I mentioned the phrase artisan engineering, if you will.
Yeah.
And it seems like technologically we are at a place where, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, you might have a great idea, but you would have probably, if you wanted to develop it, you probably had to sell it to some corporate interest, because that was the only people with the wherewithal to have to build the item.
Exactly. And you probably, even before then, in the past, you might have joined a large company because they had a great shop, you know, or they had other expertise in that company that you couldn't tap, and not just engineering expertise, but maybe marketing expertise.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing under this artisan label is, well, you know, the tools are more accessible, they're more affordable. You can go with find places in your community if you can't set them up yourself, where you can get access to these tools. The methods of use really are embedded in software, which is also getting easier to use. And then you have this gift of the internet to be able to market and sell things and let people know what you're doing. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody can be a millionaire doing this, but people can get started. I think one of the key ingredients in this is that prototyping is much easier. So you can take that idea and make it a reality much more cheaply than you ever could. And you can take that thing, show it to people, have them test it, and then you know, you can make a decision about whether that's a good business idea worth investing more money and making more of them. But in the past, it was pretty hard to even build prototypes. So good ideas just remained on the sketch pad or in your head. They didn't really get out into the world. And I think the real revolution here is that a person, an ordinary person with a good idea, can push that along a lot further than they could in the past.
Yeah, I think even if the commercial applications were obvious, to build a prototype, you pretty much had to bring somebody else in, either some money or sell part of your idea to get a prototype built. My guest today is Dale Doherty. He is founding editor and publisher of Make Magazine. He'll be the keynote speaker at the Hardesty Center for Fab Lab Tulsa, who is hosting the U.S. Fab Lab Symposium Tuesday through Thursday. And these Fab Labs are one of these sort of gathering places. They're kind of like the homebrew clubs of computing back in the 60s and 70s, where people were starting to develop personal computers. These Fab Labs are, you know, how are they affecting the abilities of inventors, engineers, designers to produce and market their own work?
Well, it's, on one hand, it's access to tools and expertise and really a sense of community around that. So today I was visiting a local high school, and we were looking at what used to be the auto shop. It's down to two sections. The teacher really isn't very motivated. The kids aren't really going there. There's a wood shop, but that's a really separate thing. And the old tech lab, where a teacher passed away 2 years ago, they never rehired the position and took all the welding and equipment, pushed it to the back and converted it into a regular classroom. And I'm trying to bring those back, whether they're Fab Labs, makerspaces. There's some different names for these things, but I think they belong in our communities, and I think they've been sort of ignored and not valued. If we were kicking out, they're saying we're canceling AP Physics or AP Math, we'd have, you know, people attending school board meetings and seriously objecting, but it seems like parents don't seem to care in the way that they might. What I want to change that discussion around is these things like Fab Lab came out of MIT, and a lot of the work we see in the maker community, we think they're the future of technology, and this is not about like looking to the past and saying, oh, we're just trying to create machinists. No, we're trying to create people who think differently about how things are made and what we can do and how we solve problems in the world.
And we think of this as being very expensive, this whole idea of digital fabrication, but a 3D printer is, you know, not nearly as expensive as it used to be. As I've read about this, it's sort of like the way digital filmmaking is democratized filmmaking,
right?
Or
exactly.
Audio recording.
No, it's a really good analogy, because think about, 10 years ago, would you have thought of editing, you know, your own video? Most of us didn't have any understanding of what that analog process was. First of all, you needed very special equipment to do it, and you needed skills. And software has come in there, and to make that kind of so we not only got cheap cameras, but we've gotten good software to be able to allow almost anyone to edit video and create anything from a home movie to a documentary film or a feature film. So that really changed everything, and gosh, we sometimes barely notice. And I think when we get into, say, creating 3D objects, right now we kind of like, how would I do that? That seems kind of like hard, and only certain kinds of engineers would do that. But we think the software is getting better, and the tools are getting more accessible. So we're going to see a lot more people doing that, and that democratizes, you know, entire technology, just as it did with, you know, going from mainframes to personal computers.
And again, those sort of think spaces, this is also a big part of it. As you were talking about the old tech level, big open space, you have room for a number of people to be together, to think together, and to collaborate and make a better mousetrap or tinker with and make the more crazy thing.
Yes. I think collaboration is one of the most important skill sets to have today, not just even collaborating in person, which is important, but even collaborating across the internet. You can build up expertise, solve problems. You don't have to do it all yourself. You can find other people that can help you, and they enjoy helping you. And, you know, the Fab Labs are examples of places that bring people together, and they get to know each other, trust each other, learn from each other. And that accelerates what we can do. If we all worked alone in our garages as we might have 50 years ago, well, it's hard to kind of, you know, look over and see someone else doing something and say, I didn't know you could do that, you know, and just go over and talk to them and ask them to show you how they do that. So with that and the rise of the Internet, I think we have lots of ways to increase collaboration, and that means increase the pace of learning, increase our ability to do new things.
If we can create a new generation of makers, if you will, and I think that's one of your central aims of Make Magazine and all your work, how's this likely to transform our society how it's going to change how we think of American ingenuity? Because I think this is one of our central traits.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one of the visions I have is tied to what some people call the erosion of the middle class. And, you know, it isn't just that, you know, middle class jobs are hard to come by and other things like that. But, you know, there were middle class values that have been eroded, like tinkering. You know, it used to be that if you could tinker, you had a little bit better home. Your car lasted longer. You lived a better life because of those skills. And I think, you know, this sort of comes back to, you know, when we frame ourselves just in terms of what we can buy rather than what we can do, we're limiting ourselves. And I think we're limiting our satisfaction and enjoyment of life, and we're limiting our capacity to develop as a real producer and contributor in our society. So my goal is, I think, in this DIY mindset, we start looking around us and say, why am I waiting for someone else to solve this problem? I can do this myself, and I can actually work with a lot of people and will enjoy, you know, solving this problem. I don't care whether it's repairing a pothole in the street or picking up garbage or you know, coming up with a way to solve an irrigation problem or an energy problem. You know, it's something that we feel empowered to do rather than waiting for other people to do it for us.
I think one of the interesting things I like about what you're doing is you're not only celebrating, you know, big ideas, but crazy ideas like the skyscraper bike or a scooter that's powered by an electric power drill. And you celebrate those ideas as well.
Yeah. Well, we have this event where we do this in a major way. We call it Maker Faire. And the next one will be in the Bay Area, May 19th and 20th. And you know, we have about 100,000 people come to check out the event on the weekend. And about 1,000 or more makers set up these kind of exhibits. And it's just amazing what people do. And you come away feeling so optimistic about each other and what each of us has this capacity to create and do things that make us laugh or amaze us and make create a sense of wonder or just impress us with technical detail and capability. So I think it's important that this making has this broad spectrum of application. It isn't just I'm going to make the better mousetrap and create a business, but it is, hey, a group of friends got together and we started thinking about how to make a carnival ride out of bicycles. And we thought it'd be fun to build that, and we thought it'd be fun if we let other people ride it. So these are things, maybe small things, but they make our communities better.
Hmm. What's the craziest thing you've seen at Maker's Faire?
Oh, there's so many. It really is. You know, it's a 19-foot-tall robotic giraffe is one of my favorite ones, and people ride it around, and it lowers its head and lets kids pet it. And, we have musical Tesla coils, so it's like guys are playing rock and roll and causing the sparks to fly in a large dark room. There's any number of things. And the question that I always have is like, I could never make anybody do any of this. Nobody. There's no amount of money out there that would make anybody do any of this. They have to do it because they love to do it, and they just came up with a crazy idea, and they said, I got to do it.
Well, it's interesting that, we've gone from this rhetoric of Americans don't make anything anymore to really starting to celebrate what we are making, whether it is something crazy or a new idea that might change our life.
And I think Maker Faire has been this wonderful context of trying to find this stuff in our community and make it visible, because it's not always obvious that, that person who lives across the street from you in his garage, he's making, airplane parts. The person that lives, has a little warehouse in an light industrial area is doing something you'd be surprised. Like, people are doing things today out of a garage that NASA, required large warehouses and million-dollar budgets to do. They're launching weather balloons. They're putting small satellites into space.
I think that's one of the things you've talked about. You can put a satellite into space for $8,000.
Right.
A group of kids did that, or a group of engineers.
And even people are leaving NASA to go do that. because they wanted to build rockets. They wanted to get things into space. Some of this comes with, building a telemetry system, building a way to capture the video of that flight. And, our very first project in Make was, major project, was kite aerial photography. And it was just, it was a professor from the University of California, Berkeley. He was an architecture professor who began using a kite to raise a camera up in the air, so he could take pictures of buildings and get an idea of what they look like from different angles and from different heights. And, he says if you're up in a plane, you're always looking straight down at the top of the building, on the roof of the building. You don't really get to see what it looks like. And if you're standing on the ground, you're just always looking up at it. But it started for him as just, hey, I'd build a rig and put a camera up in the air and be able to take a range of pictures and get it. Literally a bird's eye view of the world around me. And he began mapping the coastline and going to parks and taking pictures of people from different angles. And it became a hobby for him as well. So it really fascinating to me how that comes together. But now, we've kind of over the years, in a short number of years, we've produced the magazine. We have you know, 18-year-olds launching weather balloons with the same kind of cameras in them and getting, you know, into near space and taking pictures of, you know, the coastline and other things. And, you know, there's something wonderful about that. We've always wanted to do that as human beings, to see the world differently from a new perspective.
You know, our Fab Lab here in Tulsa is newly opened, and they're, of course, hosting the U.S. Fab Lab Symposium, which you'll be the keynote speaker of. What sort of changes does a Fab Lab provide for a community? Something like that, a fabrication laboratory.
I think we're trying to, you know, in these communities, in a sense, build the capacity to make things using new technologies and new techniques. So we're training people in new ways to do things. But as importantly, we're teaching them to think new ways or inviting them to think in new ways about what can be done if we have these tools. And I think also importantly is it's potentially giving people access to these tools who might not otherwise be able to afford that access.
So in many ways,
the importance of schools and things like that.
Yeah, an engineer might not come up with a great new idea at a Fab Lab, but it might change the way he thinks about something. He has a problem during his day gig, and it creates a new solution.
Right. Well, as we said earlier in our conversation, it's just, you know, if that engineer starts using the Fab Lab and he comes up against something that he can't buy, he starts to think, you know, I could make that, and I could design it on a computer, and I could press a button or two and have that fabricated here. And I might not get it right the first time, but subsequently, now this is in my tool set. I have this capability that I never had before. And, you know, we're talking about this, but to be able to make one-of-a-kind objects or one instance of something, it's really hard in the traditional manufacturing world. You know, you have to design something, and you can maybe make a clay model or something, but that's not a functional model. But you can actually start to prototype and make things and test them out and see if they actually work as you expected and improve them. So you're able to iterate faster rather than just, say, design on a computer and look at the thing. You're actually able to hold the physical thing and see if it works.
All right. Well, we look forward to your keynote speech as part of the U.S. Fab Lab Symposium here in Tulsa. Dale Doherty, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rich.
Dale Doherty is the publisher and founder of Make Magazine and the founder of the Maker Faire. He'll be the keynote address speaker for Hardisty Center for Fab Lab Tulsa as they host the 2012 Symposium for the United States Fab Lab Network. There'll be 100 representatives from Fab Labs, Hackerspaces, and the Make Movement coming to Tulsa Tuesday through Thursday. If you'd like more information about the panel discussions and speakers from Fab Labs and Hackerspaces from around the U.S., visit fablabtulsa.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, visit our website at publicradiotulsa.org. You can listen to them on demand anytime. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The Oklahoma Center for Poets and Writers invites you to an evening with Alexander McCall Smith, the well-known author of the best-selling number one ladies detective agency series, the Sunday Philosophy Club series, and many other books. He'll appear at the auditorium at OSU Tulsa April 17th at 7 p.m., and this event is listed at myticketoffice.com if you'd like to purchase tickets, or for more information, you can call 918-594-8215.